The University of Wisconsin is a leader in many fields, and certainly green technology is no exception to that. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're joined by John Greenler, who is the Director of Education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Always great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
I really appreciate it. And Garrett Suen with us as well. He's an assistant professor in bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is associated with the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And Garrett, thank you for spending time with us today as well.
Thank you, Larry.
And it always helps if I turn your microphone on. No, we can hear you. It's great to have you with us today to talk about your research and to take a look at microbes in cows.
Yeah.
Wow. How did that ever get started? Who ever thought of that research?
Well, I mean, I actually did my postdoc in the lab of Cameron Curry's in the same department where I have my faculty position.
Yeah.
And we were part of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And Cameron encouraged me to apply for this faculty position. And so I thought, well, what area could I potentially make an impact? Because I couldn't really do the same things that he was doing being
sure.
in the same department. And I thought, well, Wisconsin is famous for cows, and I like beef, and I like milk, and I love cheese. So how about exploring the microbes? And it's an absolutely fascinating system, both being able to make impacts on the animal production side of things, but also using it as a model to further our understanding of the production of biofuels.
This is really, really cool. I love it. And what role do microbes play in... Well, firstly, what role do they play in digesting plant matter mm-hmm. By herbivores like cows?
So, and this is the same for any herbivore on Earth. An herbivore would actually not exist without their gut-associated microbes. So herbivores in and of themselves do not have the capacity to break down the plant polysaccharides that are found in the plants that they consume. For some reason, they just don't have the enzymes encoded in their genetic makeup to be able to do this. And so what they have done is they formulated the symbiotic relationship with gut microbes. And the gut microbes, what they do is they break down that plant biomass and they ferment them into nutrients usable by the hosts. And those nutrients then get absorbed by the host, and that's where their energy source comes from.
Okay. And how many microbes, how many different types are there?
And so inside of the rumen of a cow, it's predicted that there are about 1,000 different species.
Holy cow.
Isn't that amazing?
Holy cow.
Yeah. Right. Most literally.
Oh, 1,000 different ones.
1,000 different microbes, yeah.
Oh, and well, how do you study them? I mean,
we use a number of techniques. So rumen microbiology is as really the field is known as. It's been around for a while. People started studying microbes from cows they've been studying it for decades. And so we use a number of approaches. Probably the most classical approach is to simply go into the rumen and try and isolate these organisms and try and characterize them for what they can do. Can they break down specific types of plant biomass? Can they ferment specific types of short-chain fatty acids, for example, which are the nutrient sources for the cows? As technology has improved, we've been able to now get a better sense of what's actually there by using sequence-based approaches. So that's where we can actually sequence genes directly from the gut of a cow, in essence, mm-hmm. that tells us who is actually there and also tells us a little bit about what they can do. And that's really important simply because of those 1,000 microbes, we can't actually culture all of them. So there are ones that we can't even look at under a microscope and be able to play with on a petri dish just because we don't have the conditions, we don't have the technologies to be able to culture them.
Wow. So there are some you can't even study.
There are some that we cannot study because we cannot culture them. Yeah, that's correct. And that's actually true, in fact, for many different systems, not just cows.
And you culture them by...
Usually what we do is we use selective media. So we have a hypothesis walking in and we say we believe this microbe can survive solely on, let's say, cellulose. Okay. So then we create a media where the only carbon source is cellulose, and that will select for those specific microbes. But the interesting thing is a lot of these microbes live in very tight symbiotic associations with other microbes. And so if you culture it, you also need to culture its partner. And if you don't culture the partner along with it, you will never be able to get it to grow. And since these are all living in communities, it's really hard sometimes to know, you know, which of the partners you're interested in and how do you get them to grow together?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the conundrums. And that's where sequence-based approaches can really help us so that we can get a sense of the physiology just looking at the genes. And then from there, we can actually then go back and try and culture them. And that's actually been done pretty successfully in these types of systems.
They have done... You've observed it, John?
Actually, I'm really fortunate to spend a fair amount of time in the labs, you know, doing this type of research. And I really think it is some of the most exciting, you know, work that's being done broadly in microbiology. But the fact that we can utilize it for looking at, you know, how we can develop sustainable, renewable bioenergy systems, I think is a great example of where, you know, basic research meets, you know, application to kind of move forward in a sustainable energy future.
Talking today with a couple of guests, John Greenler of the who directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute, and Garrett Suen, who's assistant professor in bacteriology. He's done some really cool research relating to bovine microbes and how those microbes might help us with our energy needs. I think that's kind of that's what it is in
you
a nutshell,
bet,
isn't it?
It seems really improbable, but once you look at it carefully, it's like, well, of course, you know, we're kind of exploring biomimicry to some sense. How do we, you know, take what Mother Nature is already doing really well and utilize it, you know, for our own needs as well?
You can join in. Maybe you have a question about biofuels and about this research as well. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post your questions or your comments there. We'd certainly love to hear from you. What have you learned about microbes that relates to biofuel production?
So one of the really neat things about some of the microbes that are found inside of the rumen is that, like John said, they really mimic the entire process of what we would like to accomplish from a biofuels perspective. So you may have heard of this concept of cellulosic ethanol, right? This idea that we have all of this plant biomass. A lot of it is in the form where we can't really get access to it. You know, things like the stalks of plants where, you know, when we harvest these things from corn, we just, you know, throw them out or, you know, we fire them up and we use that as energy. That's a tremendous waste of carbon. And so a lot of these microbes, what they can do is they can take that carbon, they can break it down. And what we're looking at are ones that can specifically turn that carbon into ethanol. Okay. And so there are specific microbes in the rumen that actually can do this. And so we are actually looking at these specific microbes to get a sense of, A, how are they doing it? B, can we improve upon that process to get them to produce more of the ethanol without, of course, killing themselves?
Yeah.
And really using that as a model to further our understanding of how we might apply that on an industrial sense.
Wow. Judith was wondering if this process just takes advantage of what the cows are doing naturally to feed themselves?
Yes. In fact, It's interesting because how I like to describe it is that we've been domesticating cows for a very, very long time. What I like to argue is that we've also, in fact, domesticated the microbes. So at the same time as we've domesticated the cow and pushed the cow towards increased milk production, increased fat production for beef, to support that, you have to have a microbial community that is now even better optimized for producing the energy requirements. And so that requires organisms that are better at breaking down plant biomass, better at fermenting them into the products that the cows require. So cows don't, I mean, the cows don't normally consume ethanol. Like, that's not their natural.
No,
but some of these. Drunk, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, it's not like the Kobe beef story. But in fact, what happens is some of these organisms can be taken out of the system itself. And because they're not with their partners, they actually end up producing ethanol. which is really interesting. So there's one particular bacterium that we study called Ruminococcus albus. And the name Ruminococcus, that comes from the fact that it is isolated from the rumen.
Yeah.
And in the rumen, it actually has a partner with it, which is a methanogen. And the methanogens, of course, are responsible for producing methane. And in the cow, the Ruminococcus normally produces hydrogen, which the methanogen then utilizes to produce methane. When you take it away from its partner, it still produces hydrogen, but because the concentrations of hydrogen build up because the methanogen can't suck it up, it ends up producing ethanol instead of the normal types of short-chain fatty acids which it produces in the rumen, which would be things like acetate and propionate and things like that, which is energy for the cow.
And what products, what have you used? What have those microbes broken down to produce ethanol?
So, a lot of the energy considered to be energy feedstocks, like switchgrass, miscanthus, corn stover, the stalks of the plants. These are all things that, we provide to the microbes. Now, from a farming perspective, corn silage is a great example of this. This is something that's naturally produced on the farm, and farmers are now beginning to provide their animals with corn silage.
Harvesting as we speak.
Right.
Because it's this time of year.
Right. Yeah. And so the cows are used to this. And so based on that, we also presume that these microbes normally see this as part of their diet.
It sounds like the micro, and they don't, but it's almost as if they think about it.
You could think of it that way.
But they've just adapted.
It's a great example of natural selection. I mean, it's evolution in action. I mean, inadvertently or not, we've been kind of pushing it, as Gary was saying.
We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, and in just a second here, but a reminder that we're talking about some great research that's going on at the University of Wisconsin with our two guests, Garrett Suen, who is assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison, and John Greener, who directs education for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll be right back after the news. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at some pretty cool research that's going on now relating to cows, figuring out how to use their digestion processes, essentially, to make biofuels. And visiting with a couple of guests today, John Greener. John directs education at the Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Great to have you back, John.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
And also with us today, Garrett Suen, assistant professor in bacteriology at UW-Madison and is associated with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center as well. And Garrett, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And fermentation, you know, cows, I mean, they're real machines, aren't they? They can really produce.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we argue that they are the world's largest group of walking fermentation vats, in essence. I mean, the number of bovines that exist in the world and the capacity for fermentation inside of their rumen is just extraordinary.
So, and explain, you know, for those of us, there may be people joining us at the moment for the first time here after the news. What, talk about your research and what you're actually hoping to try and accomplish.
So, what we're looking at is the rumen as a model for biofuel production. So, cows in and of themselves have this incredible ability to consume copious amounts of plant biomass. And the microbes that live inside of the stomach break that biomass down, providing access to the carbon sources that the cows cannot naturally digest in and of themselves. And the microbes ferment them into usable nutrients for the cow. And so we're hoping to take that kind of a model, which cows have I would argue, optimized for many, many number of years through domestication practices, and maybe learn a little bit about something where we could apply that on an industrial scale for the production of biofuels.
And one of the things I think that's really special about this is the nature of the biomass that they can utilize. So, you know, we think about, and cows do eat a lot of corn grain, and clearly we currently also make a lot of biofuel, ethanol, from corn grain as well. But cows, you know, I think in a very special way are able to use fibrous plant material as well, the cellulosic material. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's the what makes up the bulk of a plant cell wall. And these are really materials that are much more sustainable to utilize for making fuel. So this is non-food material. So as Garrett has mentioned, for example, the remainder of the above-ground portion of the corn plant, after you've harvested the grain, farmers call it corn stover. So it's the leaves and stalks and stems, et cetera. Some of that needs to get turned back into the soil, but a lot of that we could be utilizing to make fuel. And you folks have probably heard about switchgrass as well, which we can grow on marginal lands. We go up to northern Wisconsin, we begin to look at some of the residues from forestry, as well. And so these are materials that are much more sustainable in terms of making fuel. We could be making big advances, more fuel and fuel that would work better in terms of where the biomass comes from, in terms of our being stewards of the land.
I should go back to something a little more basic. Bob and from Elroy phoned in and wondered, how could you give us a basic definition of what a microbe is?
Sure. I mean, microbe stems from the root word micro, so something pretty much very small. Kind of in general, it's something that you require a microscope to see, something that we can't see with the human naked eye, although that's not really true. But some examples of microbes that people are familiar with, bacteria, those are considered microbes. Fungi, in fact, are also considered microbes, even though we can see them quite clearly, especially eating them. Archaea are another group of microbes that are very well known for production of methanogens. And then there are some other microbes out there, such as the protists. Amoebas are a great example of this. And so basically, small organisms that often require the use of a microscope in order to visualize them are what we consider a microbe.
And within a cow's rumen, stomach, you will find 1,000?
You will find 1,000 different species of all of the four that I just mentioned. Bacteria, fungi, archaea, and protists. And that does not even begin to include the viruses that are found there as well.
Absolutely amazing. What if Peter on Facebook wondered, what effect could your research have on greenhouse gas emissions?
So that's a really great question. Another aspect of my lab, in fact, is to look at animal production. And greenhouse gas emissions, primarily methane, which is what people think of when they think of cows, that's really part of the digestive process. The ability of these cows to quickly and efficiently process all of this all of the plant biomass relies on the methanogens. So the methanogens actually speed up that digestive process. But one of the outcomes of that speeding up of that process is the production of methane. And some of the research that we're looking at, we've been toying around with a few ideas here. One of them is seeing whether or not we could alter that microbial community inside of the cow by diet approaches, so switching up the diet, potentially even providing microbes to the cow. Think of it like a probiotic for a cow, just like as we do in humans. That potentially could alter that microbial community and thereby also alter that population of methanogens, maybe potentially driving it lower, and that would maybe mitigate methane production. That's some ideas.
Another good example of that, and really there are many, and this is something that we track very closely as a key consideration in terms of what would make a sustainable fuel. But when we think about the types of biomass that we could convert into fuel by using these kinds of processes, we're able to move away once again from using things like corn grain. If we're using stover or switchgrass, these types of biomass are much more energy efficient. When we look at switchgrass specifically, there's because it's a perennial, you plant it once, you get 20 years plus worth of harvest. You don't have to use nearly as much fertilizer. All this translates into a lot significant reductions in energy inputs. And when we reduce those energy inputs, correspondingly, we're going to really significantly reduce, like, by an order of magnitude, for example, the amount of CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere to make that fuel. So,
very cool. Todd in Madison has a question or comment. Hi, Todd. Thanks for calling.
Oh, Thank you. I have a very basic question. Now, you're talking about using the cow's gut as a model and upscaling it to industrial size. Now, I was wondering, are you talking about a biological process using living organisms on an industrial scale? Are you talking about understanding the chemical reactions that go on in them and mimicking it in a non-organic way? I'll take my answer up here.
Thanks. Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Great question.
Yeah, so I think it's exactly as you described in the second half of your question. What we would ideally love to be able to do is leverage some of the microbes that are found inside of the cow and take that into a non-organic industrial setting. Mm-hmm. So think of like the giant fermenters, and potentially what you could do is then put in your plant biomass of choice and have this community of microbes that are going to work on that plant biomass, mm-hmm. producing your biofuel of choice. And again, a lot of it stems from the fact that many of the products that are produced in the organic system, generally speaking, we don't really consider them as biofuels in and of themselves. They're pretty good precursors, like butyrate and succinate. But the actual ethanol, there's very, very little ethanol that is actually produced inside of the rumen of the cow. It's when you take those microbes outside mm-hmm. of the context of the cow itself and you begin to change slight aspects of them. For example, that story I gave about removing it from its partner, that drives it to produce ethanol. From an energy perspective. And that's something that we would potentially want to leverage on a large scale mm-hmm. in an industrial process.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in some cases, too, like Garrett was talking about, you know, sequencing and finding the genes that are critical. In some cases, you know, it might be that the genes are isolated and we correspondingly make the proteins, the enzymes that have a lot of capacity for a specific step in that conversion. And it may be that we really end up using, you know, those enzymes to drive a particular part of that step as well. So
I'm trying to think about how you would develop or produce enough of the microbe to actually get to a level that would be, you know, on a large scale level, let's put it that way.
Right. I mean, I think there are many industries that have actually shown that this can be done. A great example is pharmaceuticals. So most of the drugs that are produced these days are actually through mm-hmm. organisms in fermenters that are producing the drug of interest.
Is that right?
Yeah, that the pharmaceutical company then harvests. You know, other industries do the same thing. The production of many of the precursors for plastics, for example, succinate, acetate, things like that. These are all microbially driven processes. And when you're talking about, you know, a 50-liter, 150-liter fermenter, the amount of, you know, plant biomass that can go into something like that and the amount a product that you can get out of that, if you've got a number of plants running like that 24/7.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the thing that I like to think about within the, you know, bioenergy economy is that, you know, remember that the production of cellulosic ethanol as one example, that's just one part of the pie, mm-hmm. right? I mean,
right.
I don't think it's the silver bullet that's going to solve all of our energy needs. Mm-hmm. It's just one small piece. And so if we can even make a small little dent into that, that still has a pretty significant impact.
Right. Yeah, I think in many cases, long run, we'll probably be looking at, you know, fuels other than ethanol replacing gasoline. I think long run, things like diesel, it's mm-hmm. pretty clear it's going to become a far more important fuel. You know, and there's a lot of microbes and corresponding metabolic pathways in those microbes will allow us to essentially make a drop-in substitute for something like diesel or jet fuel as well, which really, I think, you know, over time will be coming. There'll be increased demand as gasoline cars become more efficient. We begin to move more towards electric vehicles. Demand for gasoline is going to drop. And correspondingly, I think, you know, that we'll see that for ethanol as well.
And so the new fuel then will be...
It's a really interesting question. This is where we actually have some very significant projects working with the Engine Research Center here on campus. You know, and we're teaming up with them. We're saying, well, you look 30 years down the road, what kind of engine do you see is going to be in most demand? And then correspondingly, they're like, well, what kind of biofuel are we going to see 20 or 30 years from now, so that, you know, we're actually hoping to be on the same trajectory. So we know what the ideal engine is going to be and what kind of fuel it's going to need. And then at the same time, we can be informing, you know, what are some of the options in terms of sustainable fuels down the road. So, Larry, that's a really interesting question. We're really trying to make sure that, you know, we're teamed up once again in a very interdisciplinary way to really get those kinds of answers right the first time. We don't end up with the wrong fuel at the wrong place and time. So
it's really interesting to think about that of a better or more efficient engine, but then can there be a more efficient fuel too?
Totally. And the good news in this is that it really looks like, you know, the engines of the future are also going to be much more adaptable to the range of fuels that we're going to be able to make through these biological systems.
It's
a real, you know, really exceptional opportunity that's coming down the pike. So you might be driving, you know, across the country, for example, and you may fill up with fuel A, you know, on the East Coast, and you switch over to the Midwest, and you maybe switchgrass powered for a while. You get over to the West Coast, and maybe something coming from a residue of the forestry industry or whatever, and there'll be some different chemical properties, but these new engines will be much more adaptive. The computer technology and the chemistry they're looking at will mean we'll be much less locked in, you know, as compared to where we are now.
That's very, very cool. Roy and New Holstein, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call.
Yes. I was wondering if your guests have looked into the production that they do in Germany. They have production lines where they harvest several different crops that go into gas production just for biofuel. And also, I was wondering if I may ask another question.
Sure.
Have they looked into small farms? I'm from a 100-cow organic dairy. We've looked into putting in a methane digester, and basically we're told there's no way possible for under $2 million that we could do it. But in China and India, they produce a biomass plant that they make all their own cooking fuel and everything for about $200.
Yeah.
And I was just, would they have any ideas on where to get started with something like that? We've looked into, we have a 30,000-gallon underground manure pit that could be sealed off, and methane could be produced in it anaerobically, but through the NRCS, we've been told that that's not possible because of all the blueprints that have to be done and government regulations and all that type of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're raising some really interesting questions here, Roy. John, turn to you first.
Sure. You know, I'll just speak in part from, you know, it's the comparison that you made, which is a really interesting one in terms of Germany and here in the United States, and especially Wisconsin. And, you know, it's a really interesting study area there, because there are so many things that are parallel. You know, a lot of their in Germany, a lot of the agricultural practices and their use of livestock, there are a lot of similarities. And, you know, we do have a lot, you know, that we can learn in this area. Actually, in the past, we have an interesting study looking at policies and how, you know, our governmental, not just necessarily subsidies, but, you know, how do we stabilize these kinds of development opportunities? And so Gary Radloff, who's a policy person in the Wisconsin Energy Institute, has actually, you know, worked quite closely with some of these developments in Germany. And I think the answer is there's a lot that we can adopt and adapt in terms of kind of farm scale developments, as you're saying. And yeah, they're not just taking, like here in the United States, in Wisconsin, we're taking a lot of dairy residue, and we're taking the natural gas through fermentation and generating electricity. As you were intimating, the Germans are actually taking that one step further. They're cleaning that that gas up a step further, and they're actually putting it in their natural gas lines so people can cook with it, heating, et cetera. And so I think there's a lot, my understanding is there's a lot of potential for us to do that here in the United States, and especially here in Wisconsin. So,
okay.
Yeah. And you were going to add something there, Garrett?
Yeah, so just that second question you had about the anaerobic digester.
Yeah.
You know, that's great, and I'm glad you're considering that, because I think that's a great viable source to be able to increase energy production, especially on small farms like yours. My understanding of that technology is just that simply here in the States, you're right, the government regulations at this stage don't allow for the effective implementation of systems like that. I can't speak for China. I'm guessing they have much less lax government regulations, if at all.
Right.
And my understanding is that because energy is such a precious thing over in China, I wouldn't be surprised if they have a lot of government subsidies to be able to produce things like that. But I think another model that you just brought up, the Germans are doing wonderful things with anaerobic digesters. And there's a lot of research going on in terms of being able to utilize those technologies to basically make a self-energy funded farm, as they like to call it, where you can harvest that, you know, harvest the manure, take that and convert that into energy, which you then put back into the farm, which is the ideal solution, I think.
And there are some farms out there right now here in the state that are producing, they're all their own, plus enough for many other homes.
Yes. It's a good example, I think, interesting kind of thinking more broadly about energy systems. You know, if anything, I think as we look towards the future, I think, you know, increasingly we'll be more and more decentralized. We'll be looking at, you know, what are the best opportunities that we have in a particular area, a particular state or region of a state, you know, in terms of energy. And I think this is a really good example of that.
Yeah. Roy, thanks again. I appreciate the call. I want to give Lisa a chance to join us from Milwaukee. Lisa, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. A quick thought. This process for using cows in this way for this purpose, Would it be yet another way to, I mean, would do you envision more factory farms for these cows? Would these also be cows used for beef so that you'd have one cow being used for both processes? Because as we know, factory farms are one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases, according to most people, scientists.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for calling, Lisa. And let's turn to Garrett first. Garrett?
Yeah. So in terms of the bioenergy spin, we would not necessarily be using the cows themselves for the production of bioenergy at all. We would just simply be using what we've learned from them to, you know, for example, put together a large scale, you know, fermentation industrial complex, for example, just taking the enzymes of the microbes that we've learned and that we've been able to find from the cow rumen in order to do that process. But to your question of methane production, I think it's a great question in terms of moving to, as you call them, the factory farms, which are commonplace in places like Texas and out in California. You know, in terms of the level of methane produced, I think it's really the number of cows that you're talking about rather than the co-housing. I don't know if there's any studies that have been done showing that, you know, large populations of cows together would produce more methane than the smaller farms. You know, I'm very hopeful that Wisconsin does not move in that direction because I really, really love the fact that Wisconsin has small family farms. I think that is fantastic. I think it makes what Wisconsin really is. It's fantastic.
You know, and from an energy perspective, in terms of, once again, coming back and looking at the biomass that would be, you know, utilized, you know, we're really looking, if anything, of a diversification of the landscape, providing more opportunities for farmers to have different crops, which, you know, stabilizes their economics situation. And at the same time, we would be really be increasing the kind of the ecological services, so to speak, that's provided. So, I mean, these perennial crops like switchgrass, for example, do amazing things in terms of all sorts of animal diversity as well, whether you're looking at insects or birds. And really, even further down the road, we're looking at cropping systems that would include multiple species. You know, down here in southern Wisconsin would probably look a lot like a prairie as well, provide a lot of advantages and be a great aesthetic boost as well for our landscape.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you for your answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, appreciate it very much. And Claire, have you got a quick question for us?
Yes, hi. Through my experience of doing energetic healing, specifically microbial balancing for Lyme's disease in my own gut, what you do in the energetic process is partner with the microbes so that an antagonistic relationship is shifted to a beneficial environment in the gut. And it really helped me a lot. And so I think that So that's a huge idea, and in partnering with these microbes, they may do these things that humans are asking for in terms of creating biofuels without incorporating cows.
Here we are with. So she's asking, looking at a plant-based option here, and in 10 seconds.
Well, I think I really like her. Your fundamental concept of partnering with microbes. I mean, that's really what this is all about, of, finding, healthy, positive ways to work with these microbial communities.
And with that, I'm sorry, Claire, and I'm sorry, Garrett and John, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Garrett Suen, Assistant Professor of Bacteriology at UW. John Greenler directs education for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Boy, that flew by. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.